Chapter 14. Get out of there, Harry.
No, Murph, I said. Look, I think it was just someone trying to scare me, or they'd have used a gun. Can you get to those records today?
If there are matters of public record, she said, we've got the time difference on our side. What are you hoping to find?
More, I said. This whole thing stinks. Hard to put a puzzle together when you're missing pieces.
Get in touch if you learn something, Murphy said. Magic or not, attempted murder is police business. It's my business.
This time, for sure, I said.
Watch your ass, Bullwinkle.
Always. Thanks again, Murph.
I hung up and flipped through the next several pages of Genosa's scrapbook, expecting nothing but more articles. I got lucky on the last few pages. He had big, glossy, color photos there. Three women, and I recognized two of them. A subtitle beneath the first picture read, Elizabeth Guns. The photo was of Madge, Genosa's first wife. She looked like she'd been in her mid-20s in the picture, and she was more or less nude. Her hair was enormous and stiff-looking, an artificial shade of deep scarlet. She probably had to take off her makeup with a Zamboni machine. The next photo read Raven Velvet beneath a picture of a nearly Amazonian brunette I didn't recognize. She had the kind of build that fairly serious female athletes can get, where the muscles are present, defined with obvious strength, but softened and rounded enough to look more pretty than formidable. Her hair was cut in a short page boy, and at first I thought her features were really quite sweet, almost kind. But her expression was an unsmiling, haughty stare at the camera. Ex-Genosa 2, I supposed. He'd called her Lucille. The last picture was of the third former Mrs. Genosa. It was subtitled Trixie Vixen, but someone had written across it in black permanent marker, Rot in hell, you pig. There was no signature to tell who was responsible. Gee, I wonder. I flipped through the album once more, but didn't see anything new. At some point, I realized that I was delaying going down to the set. I mean, yeah, there were probably going to be naked girls doing a variety of interesting things, and I hadn't gotten laid in a depressing number of months, which probably made it sound a little more interesting. But there's a time and a place to enjoy that kind of thing, and for me, in front of a bunch of people and cameras, was not it. But I was a professional, damn it, and this was the job. I couldn't bodyguard anyone if I wasn't close enough to them to act. I couldn't figure out the source of the dark mojo without figuring out what was going on. And to do that, I needed to observe and ask questions, preferably without anyone knowing that that's what I was doing. That was the smart thing, the professional thing. Conduct covert interviews while icons of sensual beauty got it on under stage lights. Onward. I screwed up my courage, so to speak, and slipped warily out of the office and down the dimly lit hall to the studio. There were a surprising number of people there. It was an enormous room, but it still looked busy. There were a couple of guys on each of four cameras, and there were a few more on hanging scaffolds that supported the stage lighting. A crew was working on the lighted set, which consisted of a bunch of panels made to look like an old brick wall, a couple of garbage cans, a trash bin, some loading pallets, and random bits of litter. Arturo and the beflanneled Joan were at the center of the activity, speaking to each other as they moved around, placing cameras to their liking. Colt-legged Inari drifted along behind them, marking positions on a chart. The notch-eared puppy followed her clumsily around, a piece of pink yarn tied around his neck and one of the loops of Inari's jeans. The puppy's tail wagged happily. I was supposed to be doing the assistant thing, after all, so I walked over to Genosa. The puppy saw me and galloped headlong into my shoe. I leaned down and scratched his ears. "What should I do to help, Arturo?" He nodded at Joan. "Stick with her. She can show you the ropes as well as anyone. Watch, ask questions."
"Okie dokie," I said.
"You've met Inari?" Arturo asked.
"Bumped into her already," I said. The girl smiled and nodded.
"I like him. He's funny."
"Looks aren't everything," I said.
Inari's laugh was interrupted when her pants beeped. She reached into them and drew out an expensive cell phone the size of a couple of postage stamps. I scooped up the puppy and held him in the crook of one arm, and Inari untied his makeshift lead and handed it to me before walking a few steps away, phone to her ear. A harried-looking woman in sweeping skirts and a peasant blouse came half-running across the studio floor, straight to Joan and Arturo.
"Mr. Genosa, I think you better come to the dressing room, right now."
Genosa's eyes widened and his face went pale. He shot me a questioning glance. I shook my head at him and gave him a thumbs up. He let out a slow breath and then said, "What is happening?"
Joan, behind him, checked her watch, rolled her eyes, and said, "It's Trixie."
The woman nodded with a sigh.
"She says she's leaving."
Arturo sighed.
"Of course she'd say that. Shall we, Marion?"
They left, and Joan scowled.
"There's no time for that prima donna."
"Is there ever?" Her frown faded, replaced by simple weariness.
"I suppose not. I just don't understand the woman. This project means as much to her future as to everyone else's."
"Being the center of the universe is a big job. Maybe it's weighing on her nerves."
Joan threw her head back and laughed.
"That must be it. Let's get moving."
"What's first?" We went to one of the other sets, this one dressed up like a cheap bar, and started going through boxes of random bottles and mugs for a more detailed appearance. I set the puppy down on the bar, and he waddled up and down the length of it, nose down to the surface and sniffing. After a few moments, I asked, "How long have you known Arturo?" Joan hesitated for a second, then continued dressing up the set.
18 or 19 years, I think."
"He seems like a nice man." She smiled again.
"He isn't," she said. "He's a nice boy."
I lifted my eyebrows. "How so?" She rolled one shoulder in a shrug.
"He lives on the outside of his skin. He's impulsive, more passionate than he can afford to be, and he'll fall in love at the drop of a hat."
"And that's bad?"
"Sometimes," she said. "But he makes up for it. He cares about people. Here, you get that top shelf. You don't need a stepladder."
I complied. "Soon I'll move up to putting stars and angels on the tops of Christmas trees. Me and that Yeti and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer." Joan laughed again and answered me. Her words became indistinct and toneless, like the teacher in the Peanuts cartoons. My heart began to race, and a stab of both food hunger and lust went through my stomach on its way to the base of my spine. My head turned of its own volition, and I saw Lara Romani enter the studio. She'd done her hair up in a style belonging to ancient Greece or Rome. She wore a short black silk robe with matching heels and stockings. She slid over the floor with a kind of fascinating serpentine grace. I wanted to watch without moving, but some stubborn part of me shoved my brain into an intellectual cold shower. She was a life-draining vampire. I'd be stupid to let myself keep on reacting that way. I tore my eyes off of her and realized that the puppy had come to the edge of the bar near me. He was crouched, his eyes on Lara, and was growling his squeaky little growl again. I looked around and kept my eyes from moving back to her only by an effort of will. Every man in the room had become still, eyes locked on Lara as she walked.
"The woman is Viagra with legs," Joan muttered. "Though I've got to admit, she knows how to make an entrance."
Yeah.
Lara took a seat in a folding chair, and Inari hurried over to kneel beside it in conversation. The electric sense of desire and compulsion faded a little, and people started moving about their tasks again. I helped Joan out and kept the puppy near me, and in half an hour the first scene started shooting with Jake Guffey and a somewhat sullen-looking Trixie Vixen on the alley set.
"Okay, let me tell you something. Porno sex is only loosely related to actual sex. The actors are constantly getting interrupted. They have to keep their faces turned in the right direction, and the body angling they have to do for the camera would make a contortionist beg for mercy. Every once in a while, someone has to touch up their makeup, and it isn't only on their faces. You wouldn't believe where it all goes. There are lights shining in their eyes, people with cameras moving all around, and on top of all of that, Arturo was giving them directions from behind the cameras. Granted, my own sexual experience is somewhat limited, but I never found any of that necessary. It was embarrassing for me to watch. Maybe in the editing room the scene would turn into something sensual and alluring, but on the set, it mostly looked awkward and uncomfortable. I found excuses to look at other things, working hard to make sure one of them wasn't the lovely vampire, and I kept my eyes peeled for more deadly magic. Maybe an hour into the shoot, I glanced aside and saw Inari pacing back and forth, a phone at her ear, speaking quietly. I closed my eyes, concentrated, and started listening to her.
"Yes, Papa," she said. "Yes, I know. I will."
"I won't," she paused.
"Yes, he's here."
Her cheeks suddenly flushed pink.
"What a terrible thing to say," she protested. "I thought you were supposed to chase the boys off with a shotgun."
She laughed, glanced across the studio, and started walking away.
"Bobby, Papa. His name is Bobby."
Aha. The plot thickens. I followed Inari's glance across the studio and saw Bobby the Sullen sitting in a folding chair near Lara, wearing a bathrobe. His impressive arms were folded over his chest, and he looked pensive and withdrawn. He paid no attention whatsoever to the shoot, or to Lara, for that matter. Inari, meanwhile, had moved a little beyond the range of my focused sense of hearing. I frowned, pondered, and kept on the lookout for incoming black magic. Nothing untoward happened, beyond an audio monitor spitting sparks and dying when I walked too close to it. They shot three other scenes after that one, and I made sure not to notice much. They involved three, performers I didn't recognize, two women and another man. They must have been the crew Joan said would follow Trixie's example by showing up late. Of course, one of the people who had been on time was now in an ICU, and lucky to be there instead of the morgue. Punctuality was no protection against black magic. Sometime a bit before midnight, the puppy was asleep in a bed I'd made him out of my duster. Most of the food, without meat it seemed blasphemous to call it pizza, had been devoured. Trixie had flown into a tantrum an hour before, ranting at one of the cameramen and at Inari, and then stormed out of the studio wearing nothing but her shoes, and everyone was tired. The crew was setting up for a last scene, consisting of Emma, Bobby the Buff, and Lara Romani. I felt myself growing tense as Lara rose, and I withdrew to the back of the studio to get my thoughts together. There was a movement from the darkness at the rear of the studio, only a few feet away, and I hopped back in a reflex born of surprise and fear. A shadowy figure darted out of a corner and headed for the nearest exit. My shock became a realization of a sudden opportunity, and I didn't stop to think before I went racing after the figure. It hit the door and darted off into the Chicago night. I snatched my blasting rod from my backpack as I ran by and sprinted into pursuit, bolstered by anger and adrenaline, determined to catch the mysterious lurker before any more of the crew could be attacked. Chases down dark Chicago alleys were getting to be old hat for me, though technically I suppose we weren't in Chicago proper, and the broader, more generous spaces between the buildings of the industrial park could hardly qualify as alleys. Foot chases still happened often enough that I had taken up running for practice and exercise. Admittedly, I was usually on the other end of a foot chase, mostly due to my personal policies on hand-to-hand combat with anything that weighed more than a small car, or could be described with the word chitinous. Whoever I was after was not overly large, but he was fast, someone who had also practiced running. The industrial park was lit only sporadically, and my quarry was running west, away from the front of the park, and into, of course, totally unlit areas.
With each step, I got farther from possible help and stood a higher chance of running into something I couldn't handle alone. I had to balance that against the possibility that I could stop whoever had been attacking Genosa's people before they could hurt anyone else. Maybe if it hadn't been mostly women who were hurt, and maybe if I didn't harbor this buried streak of chivalry, and if I were a little smarter, it wouldn't have been such an easy choice. The shadowy object of my pursuit reached the back of the industrial lot and sprinted across 20 feet of almost pitch-black blacktop toward a 12-foot fence. I caught up to him about halfway across, just managing to kick at one heel. He was running all out, and the impact fouled his legs and threw him down. I dropped my weight onto his back and rode him down into the asphalt. The impact nearly knocked the wind out of me, and I imagine it did worse to him. The grunt as he hit came out in a masculine baritone, much to my relief. I've been thinking in terms of him, because if I've been thinking her, I don't think I could have kept myself from holding back in the violence department, and that's the kind of thing that can get you hurt, fast. The guy tried to get up, but I slammed my forearm into the back of his head a few times, bouncing his face against the asphalt. He was tough. The blows slowed him down, but he started moving again and suddenly twisted with the sinuous strength of a serpent. I went to one side. He got out from under me and immediately leapt for the fence. He jumped 4 or 5 feet up and started climbing. I pointed my blasting rod at the top of the fence, drew in my will, and snarled, "Fuego!" Fire lashed across the top of the fence, bright and hot enough that the suddenly expanding air roared like a crack of thunder. Metal near the top of the fence glowed red, running into liquid a few feet above the man's head. Droplets pattered down like hell's own rain. The man cried out in shock or pain and let go of the fence. I beat him about the head and shoulders with my blasting rod when he did, the heavy wood serving admirably as a baton. The second or third blow stunned him, and I got the blasting rod across his neck in a choke, locked one of his arms behind him with a move Murphy had taught me, and pinned his face against the fence with my full weight. "Hold still," I snarled. Bits of molten wire slithered down the chain-length fence toward the ground. "Hold still, or I'll hold your face there till it melts off." He tried to struggle free. He was strong, but I had all the leverage, so that didn't mean much. Thank you, Murphy. I wrenched his trapped arm up until he gasped with pain. I snarled, "Hold still!" "Jesus Christ!" Thomas stammered, his voice pained. He ceased struggling and lifted his other hand in surrender. Recognizing the voice, I could place his profile, too.
"Harry, it's me!"
I scowled at him and pulled harder on his arm.
"Ow!"
he gasped.
"Dresden! What are you doing? Let go! It's me!"
I growled at him and did, shoving him hard against the fence and standing up. Thomas rose slowly, turning to me with his hands lifted.
"Thanks, man. I didn't mean to surprise you like..."
I hit him solidly in the nose with my right fist. I think it was the surprise as much as the blow that knocked him onto his ass. He sat there with his hands covering his face and stared up at me. I drew up my blasting rod and readied another lash of flame. The tip of the rod glowed with a cinder-red glow of light barely a foot from Thomas's face. His normally pale face was ashen, his expression was startled, and his mouth was stained with blood.
"Harry,"
he began. "Shut up," I said. I used a very quiet voice. Quiet voices are more frightening than screams.
"You're using me, Thomas." "I don't know what you're talking about."
I leaned forward, the blazing end of the blasting rod making him squirm backward.
"I told you to shut up,"
I said in the same quiet voice.
"There's someone I think you know on the set, and you didn't tell me about that. I think you've lied to me about other things, too. And it's put me in mortal peril at least 1.5 times today already. Now, give me one good reason I shouldn't blast your lying mouth off your face right now."
The hair on the back of my neck suddenly tried to crawl away from my skin. I heard 2 distinct clicks behind me, the hammers being drawn back on a pair of guns, and Lara's maddeningly alluring voice murmured,
"I'll give you two."
Chapter 15. The first thought that went through my mind was something like, "Wow, her voice is hot." The second was, "How the hell did she catch up to us so quickly?" Oh, and somewhere in there, the practical side of me chimed in with, "It would be bad to get shot." What came out of my mouth was, "Is your last name really Romani?" I didn't hear any footsteps, but her voice came from closer when she answered,
"It was my married name, briefly. Now, please step away from my little brother."
Hell's bells. She was his sister? Familial dementia. She might not react rationally to a threat. I took a deep breath and reminded myself that under the circumstances, I'd be an idiot to push Lara Wraith. "I assume that when I do, you'll lower the guns?"
"Assume instead that if you don't, I'll shoot you dead."
"Oh, for the love of God," Thomas sighed. "Lara, would you relax? We were just talking." She clucked her teeth, a sound of almost maternal disapproval. "Tommy, Tommy, when you say ridiculous things like that, I have to keep reminding myself that my baby brother isn't as large an idiot as you would like us all to believe."
"Oh, come on," Thomas said. "This is a waste of time."
"Shut up," I said with an ungracious waggle of the blasting rod. I looked over my shoulder at Lara. She was wearing black lacy things with stockings and heels. How the hell had she caught up to us in the freaking heels? Even for a wizard, some things are simply beyond belief. And she held a pair of pretty little guns in her hands. They probably weren't packing the high-caliber ammunition of heavier weapons, but even baby bullets could kill me just fine. She held them like she knew what she was doing, and sauntered closer through the heavy shadows, her skin luminous and showing, and really gorgeous. I gritted my teeth and beat back the sudden urge to taste test the curvy dents in her stomach and thighs, and kept the blasting rod lit and pointing at Thomas. "Back off, Toots. Put the guns down, stop with the come-hither whammy, and we can talk." She stopped between one step and the next, a faintly troubled expression on her face. She narrowed her eyes, and her voice slid through the air like honey and heroin.
"What did you say?"
I fought off the pressure of that voice and growled, "Back off." My inner Quixote was not to be entirely denied, though, and I added, "Please." She stared at me for a moment and then blinked her eyes slowly, as if seeing me for the first time. "Empty night," she murmured, her tone one of someone speaking an oath.
"You're Harry Dresden."
"Don't feel bad. I cleverly concealed my identity as Harry the production assistant." She pursed her lips, which also looked delicious, and said,
"Why are you threatening my brother?"
"It was a slow night and everyone else was busy." There wasn't even the hint of a warning. One of the little guns barked, there was a flash of scarlet pain in my head, and I collapsed to one knee. I kept the blasting rod trained on Thomas and lifted my hand to my ear. It came away wet with droplets of blood, but the pain had begun to recede. Lara arched a delicate eyebrow at me. Hell's bells. She'd grazed my ear with a bullet. With that kind of skill, between the eyes would be no trick at all.
"Normally I would admire that kind of piquant retort," she said in a silken, quiet voice,
probably because she thought it sounded scarier than if she said it loudly.
"But where my little brother is concerned, I am in no mood to play games."
"Point taken," I said. My voice sounded shaky. I lowered the blasting rod until it wasn't pointing at Thomas and eased away the power held ready in it. The sullen fire at the tip of the rod went out.
"Lovely," she said, but she didn't lower the twin pistols.
The autumn's evening breeze blew her dark, glossy hair around her head, and her gray eyes shone silver in the half-light. "Harry," Thomas said.
This is my oldest sister, Lara. Lara, Airy Dresden.
A pleasure, she said. Thomas, step out from behind the wizard. I don't want one of these rounds to take you if they go through.
My guts turned to water. I still had my blasting rod in hand, but Lara could pull the trigger quicker than I could aim and loose a strike at her. Wait, Thomas said. He pushed himself up to one knee and put himself between me and the other white vampire. Don't kill him.
That earned Thomas an arched eyebrow, but a smile haunted her mouth. And why not?
There's the chance that he'll be able to level his death curse, for one.
True. And?
Thomas shrugged. And I have personal reasons. I'd take it as a favor if we could discuss the matter first.
So would I added.
Lara let the ghostly smile remain. I find myself liking you, wizard, but, she sighed, there is little room for negotiation, Thomas. Dresden's presence here is unacceptable. Arturo's independent streak is an internal matter of the White Court.
I didn't come here to interfere with the White Court, I said. It wasn't my intention at all.
She regarded me. We all know what intentions are worth. Why, then, wizard?
That's a good question, I said, turning my head deliberately to Thomas. I'd love to hear the answer.
Thomas's expression became apprehensive. His gaze flicked to Lara, and I had the sudden impression that he was preparing to move against her.
Lara frowned and said, Thomas, what is he talking about?
This is a tempest in a teapot, Lara, Thomas said. It's nothing, really.
Lara's eyes widened. You brought him into this?
Thomas began. You're damn right he did, I said. You think I'd be here for the fun of it?
Lara's mouth dropped open.
Thomas, you've entered the game now?
Thomas pressed his lips together for a few seconds, then rose slowly to his feet. He winced and put one hand to the small of his back.
Looks that way.
He'll kill you, Lara said. He'll kill you, and worse. You haven't got a fraction of the strength you'd need to threaten him.
That all depends, Thomas said.
On what? She asked.
On where the other members of the house decide to place their support.
She let out a short laugh of disbelief.
You think any of us would take your side over his?
Why not? Thomas said calmly. Think about it. Father is strong, but he isn't invincible. If he's taken down by my influence, it leaves me in charge, and I'd be a hell of a lot easier to depose than he would. But if I lose, you can blame me for putting the psychic wrist lock on you. Instant scapegoat. Life goes on, and the only one to pay for it is me.
She narrowed her eyes. You've been reading Machiavelli again.
To Justine, at bedtime.
Lara became quiet for a moment, her expression pensive. Then she said,
This is ill-advised, Thomas.
But
your timing is horrible. Wraith's position is already precarious among the houses. Internal instability now could leave us vulnerable to Scavis or Malvora or those like them. If they sense weakness, they won't hesitate to destroy us.
Dad's losing it, Thomas countered. He hasn't been right for years, and we all know it. He's getting old. It's only a matter of time before the other lords decide to take him, and when that happens, all of us will go down with him.
She shook her head.
Do you know how many brothers and sisters have said such words to me over the years? He has destroyed them all.
They went up against him alone. I'm talking about all of us working together. We can do it.
Why now, of all times?
Why not now?
She frowned at Thomas and stared intently at him for better than 60 seconds. Then she shivered, took a deep breath, and pointed one gun at my head and the other at Thomas.
Lara, he protested, take your hand out from your back. Now.
Thomas stiffened, but he moved his hand from his back slowly, fingers empty.
I looked up and saw a bulge that had brushed his shirt at the belt line. Lara nodded.
I'm sorry, Tommy. I really am quite fond of you, but you do not know Father the way I do. You aren't the only Wraith who takes advantage of being underestimated. He already suspects you have something afoot, and if he thinks for a moment I'm working with you, he'll kill me without hesitation.
Thomas's voice grew desperate. Lara, if we act together, we will die together.
If not at his hands, then at Malvora's and his like. I don't have a choice. It gives me no pleasure to kill you.
Then don't do it, he said.
And leave you to Father's mercies? Even I have a few principles. I love you, as much as anyone in the world, little brother. But I did not survive as long as I have by taking unnecessary risks.
Thomas swallowed. He didn't look at me, but his balance shifted a little, and his shirt rode up enough to show me the handle of a gun he had tucked into the back of his jeans. I didn't stare at it. I wouldn't have time to grab it and shoot before Lara could gun me down, but if Thomas could distract her for a beat or two, there might be a chance. Thomas took a deep breath and said, Lara. Something in his voice had changed. The tone of it sounded the same, on the surface, but there was something beneath it that made the air sing with quiet, seductive power. It commanded attention. Hell, it commanded a lot of things, and it was creepy to hear it coming from him. I was glad that Thomas wasn't addressing me, because it would have been damned confusing. Lara, he said again. I saw her sway a little as he spoke. Let me talk to you. Evidently the sway was induced more by the evening breeze and those high heels than it was by Thomas's voice.
I'm afraid all you need say is goodbye, little brother.
Lara thumbed back the hammer on both guns, her features calm and remote.
And you'd best say it for the wizard as well.
Chapter 16. I'd been in hairier situations than this one. Actually, it's sort of depressing, thinking how many times I'd been in them. But if experience had taught me anything, it was this. No matter how screwed up things are, they can get a whole lot worse. Case in point, our little standoff with Supertart. Thomas shouted and darted to his left, across my view of Lara. As he went, I reached for the pistol tucked into the back of his jeans. Judging by the grip, it was semi-automatic, maybe one of those fancy German models that are as tiny as they are deadly. I grabbed it, and felt pretty slick to be doing the teamwork thing, but Thomas's damn jeans were so tight that the gun didn't come loose. I leaned too far in the effort and wound up sprawling on my side. All I got for my oh-so-clever maneuver was scraped fingertips and a good view of Lara Wraith in gunfighting mode. I heard a shot go past, a kind of humming buzz in the air that provided an accent to the mild, barking report of the pistol. There were several shots in the space of a second or three. Two of them hit Thomas with ugly sounds of impact, one in the leg and a second in the chest. At the same time, he hurled a small ring of keys at Lara, and it probably saved my life. She swatted them aside with the gun that had been trained on me. It gave me a precious second or two, and it was time enough to bring up my blasting rod and loose a panic strike at her. It was sloppy as hell, even with the blasting rod to help me focus my will, and instead of a wrist-thick beam of semi-coherent flame, it came out in a cone of fire maybe 30 feet across. That made a big noise, a thunderous, thumping explosion as the heat displaced cool night air. Lara Wraith had the reflexes that were depressingly common in all of the vampire types, and she darted out of the way of the flames. She leveled both guns at me as she did, blazing away like in those Hong Kong action movies. But evidently, even Lara's superhuman skill wasn't enough to overcome surprise, lateral movement, a firestorm, and spike heels. God bless the fashion industry and the blind luck that protects fools and wizards. She missed. I shook out my shield bracelet and hardened my will into a wall of unseen but solid force in front of me.
The last few shots from Lara's guns actually struck the shield, illuminating it in a flash of blue and white energy. I held the shield firmly in place and readied the blasting rod again and faced Lara squarely. The vampire slipped into the shadows between the nearest building and a pair of huge industrial tanks and vanished from sight. I padded forward to Thomas, keeping the shield up and in the general direction of where Lara had disappeared.
"Thomas,"
I hissed.
"Thomas, are you all right?"
It was a long beat before he replied, his voice weak and shaking.
"I don't know. It hurts. You've been shot. It's supposed to hurt."
I kept my eyes on the shadows, warily extending my senses as much as I could.
"Can you walk?"
"Don't know,"
he panted.
"Can't get my breath. Can't feel my leg."
I flicked my eyes down to him and back out again. Thomas's black T-shirt was plastered to his chest on one side. He'd taken a hit in the lung, at least. If a major blood vessel had been struck, he was in trouble, vampire or not. The White Court were a resilient bunch, but in some ways, they were just as fragile as the human beings they fed upon. He could heal up fast. I'd seen Thomas recover from broken ribs in a matter of hours. But if he bled out from a severed artery, he'd die, like anyone else.
"Just hold still," I said. "Don't try to move until we know where she is."
"That'll get her,"
Thomas panted.
"The old sitting duck ploy."
"Give me your gun," I said.
"Why?"
"So that the next time you start talking, I can shoot your wise ass."
He started to laugh, but it broke into agonized, wet coughing.
"Damn it,"
I muttered, and crouched down beside him. I set my blasting rod aside and slipped my right arm and one knee behind his back, trying to hold him vertical from the waist up.
"You'd better get moving. I'll manage."
"Would you shut up?"
I demanded. I tried to ascertain the extent of his injuries with my free hand, but I'm no doctor. I found the hole in his chest, felt the blood coming out. The edges of the wound puckered and gripped at my hand.
"Well," I told him, "your wound sucks. Here."
I took his right hand and pressed it hard against the hole.
"Keep your hand there, man. Keep the pressure on. I can't hold it and carry you out, too."
"Forget carrying me,"
he rasped.
"Don't be an idiot. She'll kill us both."
"I can hold the shield," I said.
"If you can't return fire, it won't do you much good. Get clear. Call the cops and come back for me."
"You're delirious," I said. If I left him there alone, Lara would finish him. I got my right shoulder under his left arm and hauled him to his feet. He wasn't as heavy as I would have expected, but dragging him up like that had to have hurt him. The pain locked the breath in his throat.
"Come on," I growled. "You've got a good leg. Help me."
His voice had become hollow, somehow ghostly, barely more than a whisper.
"Just go." "I can't."
"You can. Shut up and help me." I started walking as fast as I could back toward the street end of the industrial park. I kept my shield bracelet up, focusing my will into a barrier all around us. It wasn't as strong as a more limited directional shield, but my eyes couldn't be everywhere, and a smart opponent would shoot me in the back. Thomas would have been screaming if he could have gotten his breath. Over the next minute or two, his face went white. I mean, even more so than usual. He'd always been pale, but his skin took on the gray tone of a corpse, sooty hollows forming under his eyes. Even so, he managed to help me. Not much, but enough that I could keep us both moving without stumbling. I started to think that we were going to make it back safely when I heard running footsteps and a woman rounded the corner ahead of us, her pale skin glowing in the dimness. I cursed, pushing more will into the shield, and crouched down, letting Thomas collapse ungraciously onto the gravel parking lot. I fumbled for his gun, found it, and whipped the weapon up. I flicked off the safety with my thumb, took a half-second to aim, and pulled the trigger.
"No!"
Thomas gasped at the last possible instant. He leaned hard against me just as the gun went off. The barrel wavered, and the shot kicked up sparks on a concrete retaining wall 50 feet away. Panicked, I lined up the weapon again, though I knew it would be a useless gesture.
I might have taken her out with a surprise shot, but there was no chance at all that I could outshoot Lara Wraith in a direct confrontation. But it wasn't Lara. I couldn't see very far in the dimness, but Inari stumbled to a halt only a few feet shy of me, her eyes wide and her mouth open.
"Oh, my God," she cried. "Thomas, what happened? What have you done to him?"
"Nothing," I said. "He's been hurt. For the love of Pete, help me." She hesitated for a second, her eyes wide, and then rushed forward to Thomas.
"Oh, my God, there's blood. He's bleeding."
I shoved my blasting rod at her. "Hold this," I snapped.
"What did you do to him?"
she demanded. She had begun weeping.
"Oh, Thomas."
I felt like screaming in frustration, and I tried to look at every possible place Lara might be, all at the same time. My instinct screamed that she was getting closer, and I wanted nothing more than to run away.
"I told you nothing. Just get moving and open the doors for me. We have to get back inside and call 911.
I bent down to pick up Thomas again. Inari Wraith screamed in grief and rage. Then she used my blasting rod with both hands to clout me on the back of the neck with so much force that it snapped in half. Stars exploded over my vision, and I didn't even feel it when my face hit the gravel. Everything got real confused for a minute or two, and when I finally started stirring, I heard Inari crying.
"Lara, I don't know what happened. He tried to shoot me, and Thomas isn't awake. He might be dead."
I heard footsteps on the gravel, and Lara said, "Give me the gun."
"What do we do?"
Inari said. She was still crying. Lara worked the slide on the gun with a couple of quiet clicks, checking the chamber. "Get inside," she said, her tone firm and confident. "Call emergency services and the police. Now." Inari got up and started to run off, leaving Thomas and me alone with the woman who had already half killed him. I tried to get up, but it was difficult. Everything kept spinning around. I managed to get to one knee, just as a cold, slithery feeling washed down my spine. The three vampires of the Black Court did not announce their presence. They simply appeared, as though formed from the shadows. One of them was the one-eared vamp I had smacked with the holy water balloon. On either side of him stood two more Black Court vamps, both male, both dressed in funeral finery, and both of teenage proportions. They hadn't been living corpses for very long. There were lividity marks on the arms and fingers of the first, and their faces hardly looked skeletal at all. Like the maimed vampire, they had long, dirty fingernails. Dried blood stained their faces and throats, and their eyes were filmy, stagnant pools. Inari screamed a horror movie scream and stumbled back to Lara. Lara sucked in a sharp breath, bringing the gun to a point-down firing stance, spinning in a slow circle to watch each of the Black Court vamps in turn.
"Well, well," rasped the maimed vampire. "What luck! The wizard and three whites to boot. This will be entertaining."
At which point I felt another, stronger slither of vile and deadly magical energy. The Molochio. It was forming again, more powerfully than before. And I sensed that the deadly spell was already near and gathering more vicious power as it headed my way. Still dazed, I couldn't do a damn thing about it.
"Kill them," the Black Court vampire whispered. "Kill them all."
See what I mean? It's just like I said. Things can always get worse. Chapter 17. I'm not hopeless at hand-to-hand, but I'm not particularly talented either. I've been beaten senseless once or twice. Well, a lot. It isn't as unlikely as it sounds. A lot of things that started pummeling me could bench-press a professional basketball team, whereas I was only human. In my neck of the woods, that meant that I was slightly tougher than a ceramic teacup. I'd managed to survive the beatings thanks to good luck, determined friends, and an evil fairy godmother, but I figured that sooner or later my luck would run out and I'd find myself alone, in danger, and at the limits of my endurance. Tonight had proven me right. So it was a good thing I'd planned ahead. I reached for my new belt buckle, with its carved design of a bear. The buckle was cast from silver, and the bear design was my own hand-carved work. It took me months to make it, though it wasn't particularly beautiful or inspirational, but I hadn't been trying for artistic accomplishment when I'd been creating it. I'd been trying to prepare myself for, in the words of Foghorn Leghorn, just such an emergency. I touched my left hand to my belt buckle and whispered,
"Fortius."
Power rushed into the pit of my stomach, a sudden tide of hot, living energy, nitrous for the body, mind, and soul. Raw life radiated out into my bones, running riot through my limbs. My confusion and weariness and pain vanished as swiftly as darkness before the sunrise. This was no simple adrenaline boost either, though that was part of it. Call it chi, or mana, or one of a thousand other names for it, it was pure magic, the very essence of life energy itself. It poured into me from the reservoir I'd created in the silver of the buckle. My heart suddenly overflowed with excitement, my thoughts with hope, confidence, and eager anticipation. And if I had a personal soundtrack to my life, it would have been playing Ode to Joy while a stadium of Harry fans did the wave. It was all I could do to stop myself from bursting into laughter or song. The pain was still there, but I shrugged off the recent blows and exertions and suddenly felt ready to fight. Even when magic is involved, there ain't no free lunch. I knew that the pain would catch up to me, but I had to focus. Survive now. Worry about the backlash later. "Lara," I said, "I realize you're kind of invested in killing me, but from where I'm standing, the situation has changed." The succubus shot a glance at the vampires and then at Inari. "I concur, Dresden. Rearrange teams and get the girl out. Can you move?" I pushed myself up, feeling pretty peppy, all things considered. Lara had her back more or less to me and was trying to keep her eyes on all three black quarters. The vampires, in turn, simply stood there with only the flicker of something hungry stirring in their dead eyes to proclaim them something other than lifeless corpses. "Yeah, I'm good to go." Lara shot a glance over her shoulder, her expression flickering with disbelief. "Impressive. Pax, then?" I jerked my chin in a nod. 24 hours? "Done."
"Groovy."
"Their faces," Inari wailed. "Their faces! My God, what are they?" I blinked at the terrified girl and shot a glance at Lara. "She doesn't know? You don't tell her these things?" The succubus shrugged a shoulder, keeping most of her attention on the nearest vampire, and said, "It's my father's policy." "Your family is twisted, Lara. It really is." I picked up the shattered halves of my blasting rod. The carvings and spells laid on the wood were difficult, time-consuming, and expensive to make. I'd had to replace maybe half a dozen rods over the years, and it was the labor of better than a fortnight to create a new one. The girl had broken mine, which annoyed the hell out of me, but the drought of positive energy still zinging through me pointed out the upside. I now had two handy shafts of wood with jagged, pointy ends. I stepped between Inari and the nearest vampire and passed her one broken half of the rod. "Here," I said. "If you get the chance, make like Buffy." Inari blinked at me.
"What? Is this a joke?"
"Do it," said Lara. Her voice was laced with iron. "No questions, Inari." The steel in the succubus's voice galvanized the young woman. She took the shard of wood without further hesitation, though her expression grew no less terrified. Overhead, the dark energy of the curse swirled around and around, a constant, intimidating pressure on my scalp. I tried to block out all the distractions, focusing on the curse and on where it was going. I needed to know who its target was, not only for the sake of my investigation, but for my immediate survival. That curse was several kinds of nasty, and as it happened, I had a constructive, life-affirming purpose for a boatload of nasty juju. I drew my silver pentacle from my neck and spoke a troubling thought aloud.
Why are they just standing there?
They're communing with their master, Lara stated.
I hate getting put on call waiting, I said, wrapping the chain of my pentacle around my fist. Shouldn't we hit them now?
No, Lara said sharply. They're aware of us. Don't move. It will only set them off, and time is our ally.
A sudden wash of almost physical cold set the hairs on the back of my neck on end. The curse was about to land, and I still wasn't sure who it was coming for. I glanced upward, hoping for a physical cue.
I wouldn't be so sure about that, Miss Wraith.
One of the vampires, the smallest of the pair, who had showed up with one ear, suddenly shuddered. Its dead eyes flickered around until they landed on me, and then it spoke. You wouldn't think there would be a whole lot of difference between the rasp of one dry, leathery, dead larynx and another, but there was. This voice flowed out, and it wasn't the voice of the vampire whose lips were moving. It was an older voice. Older and colder and vicious, but somehow tinged with something feminine.
Dresden, that voice said. And Wraith's right hand. Wraith's bastard son. And the darling of his eye. This is a fortunate night.
Evening, Mavra, I said. If it's all the same to you, can you stop playing sock puppet with the Omega Nosferatu and move this along? I've got a big day tomorrow, and I want to get to bed for it.
Christ, Harry,
came a choking voice. I looked back and saw Thomas on the ground, his eyes open. He looked like death, and he had trouble focusing on me, but at least he was lucid.
Are you drunk all of a sudden?
I winked at him. It's the power of positive thinking. The puppet vampire hissed with Mavra's anger, and its voice took on a quavering, modulated, half-echoing quality.
Tonight we'll balance many scales. Take them, my children. Kill them all.
And a lot of things went down. The vampires came for us. One ear rushed at Lara. The sock puppet went for me, and the third one headed for Inari. It happened fast. My attacker may have been new to the game and clumsy, yet it moved at such a speed that it barely registered on my thoughts. But my body was still singing with the infusion of positive energy, and I reacted to the attack as if it had been the opening steps of a dance I already knew. I sidestepped the vampire's rush and drove my half of the former blasting rod down at its back, Buffy-like. Maybe it works better on television. The wood gouged the vampire, but I don't think much of it got past its suit coat, much less pierced its heart. But the blow did manage to throw the thing off balance and send it stumbling past me. Maybe it actually hurt the vampire. The creature let out an ear-splitting, creaking shriek of rage and surprise. Inari screamed and swung her stake, but her Buffy impersonation wasn't any better than mine. The vampire caught her arm, twisted its wrist, and broke bones with a snap, crackle, pop. She gasped and fell to her knees. The vampire shoved her over and leaned down, baring its teeth, not fangs, I noticed, just yellow corpse teeth, and spreading its jaws to tear out her throat and bathe in the flood of blood. And as if that weren't enough, the curse suddenly coalesced and came shrieking out of the night to end Inari's life. I had scant seconds to act. I charged the vampire, leaned back, pictured an invisible beer can beginning an inch above the vampire's teeth, and stomp-kicked the creature in the chin with my heel. It wasn't a question of hairy strength versus undead super strength. I'd gotten the chump shot in, and while the vampire might have been able to rip through a brick wall, it only weighed as much as a dried corpse, and it didn't have enough experience to have anticipated the attack. I drove the kick home hard. Physics took over from there, and the vampire fell back with a surprised hiss. I seized Inari's right arm with my left. Energy flows out of the body from the right side. The left side absorbs energy. I stretched out my senses and felt the dark energy of the curse rushing down at Inari. It hit her a second later, but I was ready for it. And with an effort of will, I caught the dark power coursing down into the girl before it could do her harm. Pain erupted in my left palm. The power was cold,
and not mountain breeze cold, either. It was slimy and nauseating, like something that had come slinking out from the depths of some enormous subterranean sea. In that instant of contact, my head exploded with terror. This power, this black magic, was wrong. Fundamentally, nightmarishly, intensely wrong. Since I'd begun my career as a wizard, I'd always believed that magic came from life, but that it was only potential energy, like electricity or natural gas or uranium. And while it may have come from positive origins, only its application would prove it good or evil, that there was no such thing as truly evil, malevolent black magic. I'd been wrong. Maybe my own magic worked like that, but this power was something different. It had only one purpose, to destroy, to inflict horror, pain, and death. I felt that power writhe into me through my contact with the girl, and it hurt me on a level so deep that I could not find a specific word, even a specific thought, to describe it. It ripped at me within, as though it had found a weakened place in my defenses and started gouging out a larger opening, struggling to force itself inside me. I fought it. The struggle happened all within an instant, and it hurt still more to tear that darkness loose, to force it to flow on through me and out of me again. I won the fight, but I felt a sudden terror that something had been torn away from me, that in simple contact with that dark energy, I had been scarred somehow, marked, or changed. I heard myself scream, not in fear or challenge, but in agony. I extended my right hand, and the black magic flowed out of it in an invisible torrent, fastening onto the vampire as it gained its feet again and reached out to grab me. The vampire's expression didn't even flicker, so I was sure it did not feel the curse coming. Which made it a complete surprise when something slammed into the vampire from directly overhead, too quickly to be seen. There was a sound of impact, a raspy, dry scream, and the vampire went down hard. It lay on the ground like a butterfly pinned to a card, arms and legs thrashing uselessly. Its chest and collarbone had been crushed by an entire frozen turkey, a 20-pounder. The plucked bird must have fallen from an airplane overhead, doubtlessly manipulated by the curse. By the time it got to the ground, the turkey had already reached its terminal velocity and was still hard as a brick. The drumsticks poked up above the vampire's crushed chest, their ends wrapped in red tinfoil. The vampire gasped and writhed a little more. The timer popped out of the turkey. Everyone stopped to blink at that for a second. I mean, come on. Impaled by a guided frozen turkey missile. Even by the standards of the quasi-immortal creatures of the night, that ain't something you see twice. For my next trick, I panted into the startled silence, anvils! And then the fight was on again. Inari screamed in pain from her knees on the ground. Lara Wraith lifted Thomas's little gun, and tongues of flame licked from it as she shot at One Ear. She was aiming for his legs. I started to help her, but I'd been playing long odds, mixing it up in hand-to-hand with the Black Court, and they caught up to me. The vampire I'd dodged in the opening seconds of the fight slammed its arm into my shoulders. The blow was broad and clumsy, but viciously strong. I managed to roll with it a little, but it still sent me straight down onto the gravel and knocked the wind from my chest. I felt the edges of rock cut me in a dozen places at once, but the pain didn't bother me. Yet. Nonetheless, it took me a second to get my body moving again. The vampire stepped right over me and closed in on the fallen girl. With a simple, brutal motion, it seized her hair and shoved her face down onto the parking lot, baring the back of her neck. It bent forward. Thomas snarled.
Get away from her!
He hauled himself forward, using his unwounded leg and one arm, and he got the other around the vampire's leg. Thomas heaved, and the creature fell, then twisted like an arthritic serpent to grapple with him. Thomas went mano a mano, no tricks, no subtlety. The living corpse got a hand on Thomas's throat and tried to tear his head off. Thomas writhed sinuously away from the full power of the creature and then rolled over a couple of times. Thomas got hold of the thing's wrists and tried to force them away from his neck. And then Thomas changed. It wasn't anything so dramatic as the vampires of the Red Court, whose demonic forms lurked beneath a masquerade of seemingly normal human flesh. It was far subtler. A cold wind seemed to gather around him. His features stretched, changing, his cheekbones starker, his eyes more sunken, his face more gaunt. His skin took on a shining, almost luminescent luster, like a fine pearl under moonlight, and his eyes changed as well. His irises flickered to a shade of chrome-colored silver, then bleached out to white altogether. He snarled a string of curses as he fought, and the sound of his voice changed as well. Again, a subtle thing. It was more feral, more vicious, and its tone was not even remotely human. Thomas, despite his deathly injuries, went up against the Black Court killing machine in a contest of main strength, and won. He forced the vampire's hands from his throat, rolled so that his good leg came up beneath the vampire, and with the combined strength of his arms, Thomas threw the vampire into the brick wall of the nearest building. Bricks shattered, and bits and pieces of them flew outward in a cloud of stinging shrapnel. The vampire collapsed to the ground for a moment, stunned. A heartbeat later, it stirred and began to rise again. Thomas's shoulders heaved, as though to push himself up and continue the fight, but whatever fuel had driven his transformation and sudden strength had been expended. He fell limp and loose to the gravel, gaunt face empty of expression. His all-white eyes went out of focus, staring, and he did not move. Lara Wraith wasn't doing badly for herself. The wind was blowing the short little black silk robe back off of her, so it was all black lace and pale flesh that somehow did not present a contrast to the gun. One ear had fallen on his side. Shards of brittle bone protruded from both thighs and both knees, where Lara Wraith had exercised her marksmanship. One ear pushed himself up, and Lara put a shot in the arm supporting the vampire's weight. One ear's elbow exploded in a cloud of ruined cloth, moldy flesh, and bone splinters, and the creature fell back to the ground. Lara put a bullet through One ear's left eye. The smell was indescribably nauseating. Lara aimed at the vampire's other eye.
"This won't kill me," the creature snarled.
"I don't need to," Lara responded. "Just to slow you down."
"I'll be after you in hours,"
One ear, One eye said. "Look somewhere sunny," she responded. "Au revoir, darling." The gun's hammer clicked down, and silence ensued. Lara had time to blink in disbelief at the gun. Then the vampire Thomas had stunned rushed at Lara's back. The creature wasn't quite a blur, but it was fast as hell. I tried to shout a warning at her, but it came out more of a croak than anything. Lara shot a glance over her shoulder and started to move, but my warning had come too late. The vampire seized her by her dark hair and spun her around. Then it hit her with a broad swing of its arm and literally knocked her out of her high-heeled shoes. She flew at the nearest wall, half spinning in the air, and hit hard. The gun tumbled from her fingers, and she fell, her eyes wide and frightened, her expression stunned. Her face had been cut on the cheek, at the corner of her mouth, and on her forehead. She was bleeding odd, pale blood in thick, trickling lines. The vampire shuddered and leapt after her, landing on all fours. It was graceful, but alien, far more arachnid than feline. The corpse prowled over to her, seized her throat, and shoved her shoulders against the wall. Then it thrust out a long, leathery tongue and started licking her blood, hissing in mounting pleasure. One ear slithered over to her as well, using his unwounded arm and a serpentine writhing of the rest of his body.
Wraith second in command,
the vampire rasped.
As well as the White, who betrayed us. Now you're both mine.
Lara tried to push the vampire, licking her blood away, but she wasn't strong enough, and she still looked dazed.
Get away from me.
Mine,
One Ear repeated. It drew Lara's hair back away from her throat. The other vampire took her hands and pinned them against the wall above her head. One Ear touched its tongue to Lara's mouth and shivered.
I'll show you what real vampires are like. You'll see things differently soon, and you'll be lovely still. For a little while, I'll enjoy that.
Lara struggled, but the haze of confusion over her eyes did not clear, and her motions had a dreamlike lack of coordination. Her face took on an expression of horror as both vampires leaned into her, their withered teeth settling onto her flesh. They bit her, and she bucked in terror and agony. There were ugly, slurping sounds beneath Lara Wraith's screams. Which was what I'd been waiting for. Once they had bitten down, I gathered up momentum as quietly as I could, closed the last few yards in the springing strides I would have used on a fencing strip, and drove the 6-inch heel of one of Lara's black pumps as hard as I could into the space between the unwounded vampire's shoulder blades. I had the heel of my hand and the full weight of my body behind the blow, and I hit square and hard, so that the heel drove into its back, just left of its spine, directly at the vampire's withered heart. I didn't get the response I would have liked best. The vampire didn't disintegrate or explode into dust. But it did convulse with a sudden scream, its body going into almost the same kind of spastic seizure the other one had displayed on having a turkey rammed through its chest. It staggered and fell to the ground, its dead face locked into a grimace of surprise and helpless pain. One Ear was slow to react. By the time it tore its mouth from the gnawed and bleeding slope of Lara Wraith's left breast, I had my mother's pentacle out and had focused all of my attention on it. Now I've heard that the power of faith is simply another aspect of the magic I used all the time. I've also heard that it is a completely different kind of energy, totally unrelated to the living power I felt all around me. Certainly, it garnered a very different reaction from various supernatural entities than my everyday wizardry did, so maybe they weren't related at all. But that didn't matter. I wasn't holding a crucifix in the thing's face. I was holding the symbol of what I believed in. The 5-pointed star of the pentacle represented the 5 forces of the universe, those of air, fire, water, earth, and of spiritual energy, laid into patterns of order and life and bound within a circle of human thought, human will. I believed that magic was fundamentally a force of life, of good, something meant to protect and preserve. I believed that those who wielded it therefore had a responsibility to use that power in the way it was meant to be used. And that was belief enough to tap into the vast power of faith and to direct it against One Ear. The pentacle burst into silver and blue light, a blaze as bright as an airborne flare. One Ear's stretched facial skin began to peel away, and the thick fluids oozing from its ruined eye socket burst into silver flame. The vampire screamed and threw itself away from that silver fire. If he'd had a crony left, they could have come at me from opposite directions, so that the blazing light from the pentacle could sear only one. But he didn't, and I followed after One Ear, keeping the pentacle held before me, my concentration locked upon it. One Ear scrambled over the writhing vampire with a turkey-crushed chest, and the creature, maybe younger or more vulnerable than its leader, simply burst into flame as the pentacle glared down upon it. I had to skip back a step from that sudden heat, and the fallen vampire was consumed by blinding fire until nothing was left of it. By the time my eyes had adjusted to the comparative darkness of the parking lot again, One Ear was nowhere to be seen. I checked over my shoulder and saw the transformed Lara Wraith straddle the staked vampire,
her eyes blazing silver and bright, her skin shining as Thomas's had. She drove blows down at its face, crushing it with the first few, then driving into its skull with sickening squelching sounds during subsequent blows. She continued, screaming at the top of her lungs the whole while, until she'd crushed its face and moved on to its neck, beating it into shapeless pulp. And then she tore the vampire's head off its shoulders, killing it. She rose slowly, pale eyes distant and inhuman. Her white skin was streaked with ichor of black, brown, and dark green, mingling with the pale, pinkish blood around her cuts and the bite wounds. Her dark hair had fallen from its mostly up style and hung around her in a wild tangle. She looked terrified and furious and sexy as hell. The succubus turned hungry eyes on me and began a slow stalk forward. I let the gathered light ease out of my pentacle. It wouldn't do me any good against Lara. "We have a truce," I said. My voice sounded harsh, cold, though I hadn't tried to make it that way. "Don't make me destroy you, too." She stopped in her stalking tracks. Her expression flickered with uncertainty and fear, and she looked a hell of a lot shorter without the doomy pumps. She shuddered and folded her arms over her stomach, closing her eyes for a moment. The luminous, compelling glow faded from her skin, her features becoming less unreal, if no less lovely. When she opened her eyes again, they were almost human. "My family," she said. "I have to get them out of here. Our truce stands. Will you help me?" I looked at Inari on the ground and paralyzed with pain. Thomas wasn't moving. He might have been dead. Lara took a deep breath and said, "Mr. Dresden, I can't protect them. I need your help to get them to safety. Please." The last word had cost her something. Somehow I held back from agreeing to help her on pure reflex.
"That is a monumentally bad idea, Harry," I cautioned myself.
I shoved the knee-jerk chivalry aside and scowled at Lara. She stood facing me, her chin lifted proudly. Her injuries looked vicious, and she had to be in pain, but she refused to let it show on her face, except for one moment, when she glanced at Thomas and Inari, and her eyes suddenly glistened. The tears fell, but she did not allow herself to blink.
"Damn it," I let out my breath in disgust at myself and said, "I'll get my car."
Chapter 18. I debated talking to Arturo before I left, but decided against it. Thomas and Inari were hurt, and the sooner they got medical care, the better. Additionally, One Ear, the vampire, had consciously gotten his own flunky immolated in order to escape. If he had some mystical method of communicating with Mama Mavra or a cell phone, she might already be on the way with reinforcements. One Ear was still pretty new to the vampire game, and his pair of followers had been virtual infants, and they had almost been more than all of us could handle. Mavra was in a different league entirely. She had been killing for centuries, and the near extermination of the Black Court had meant that only the smartest, strongest, and most deadly of its members had survived. One Ear was dangerous enough, but if Mavra caught us in the open, she would take us apart. So I ran to get the Blue Beetle from the row of parking spaces near the building Arturo was using. It was a quick run, a couple of plots up and one over from where Thomas and Inari lay. I slipped into the building. Only a couple of people saw me, and I ignored them as I ducked into the studio doors, seized my backpack, my coat, and the sleeping puppy, and fumbled in the coat until I found my car keys. I carried the whole kit and caboodle out to the car. I coaxed the Beetle to life and tore down the gravel lanes with all the speed its little engine could manage. The Beetle's single headlight glared over Lara, who had Thomas in a fireman's carry.
She'd taken off the short black robe and had tied it into an improvised sling for Inari, who stumbled along behind her older sister. I opened the doors and helped her lower Thomas into the back of the Beetle. Lara stared for a second at my car's interior. It didn't look like she approved of the stripped and improvised quality of it.
"There's no seat in back," she said.
"That's why there's a blanket," I answered her. "Get in. How is he?"
"Alive, for now," Lara said. "He's breathing, but he's emptied his reserves. He'll need to refresh them."
I paused and stared at her. "You mean he needs to feed on someone?" Her eyes slid aside to Inari, but the girl had her hands full, simply staying vertical through the pain, and probably wouldn't have heard the space shuttle lifting off. Nonetheless, Lara lowered her voice.
"Yes, deeply."
"Hell's bells," I said. I got the door for Inari and helped her into the passenger side seat, buckled her in, and dropped the puppy in her lap. She clutched at him with her unwounded arm, whimpering. I got the Beetle the hell away from the little industrial park. After several moments of hurried driving, I started to relax. I kept checking, but I saw no one following me. I played a few trail-shaking tricks just in case, and finally felt able to speak. "I'll get you to my place," I told Lara.
"You can't possibly think that the basement of a boarding house will be secure."
"How do you know where I live?" I demanded.
"I've read the court's defensive assessment of your home," she said with an absent wave of her hand.
Which was scary as hell, that someone had assessed my freaking apartment. But I wasn't going to show her that. "It's kept me alive pretty well. Once we get there, we can fort up under my heavy defenses. We'll be stuck inside, but safe until morning."
"If you wish, but if he does not feed, Thomas will be dead within the hour."
I spat an oath.
"Mavra knows where you live, in any case, Dresden. She will doubtless have some of her personnel waiting near your apartment."
"True," I said. "Where else could we go?"
"My family's house."
"You all live in Chicago?"
"Of course not," Lara said, her voice tired. "But we keep houses in several cities around the world. Thomas has been in and out of Chicago for the past 2 or 3 years, between resort vacations. Justine is at the house, waiting for him."
"Inari will need a doctor."
"I have one," she said, then added, "on retainer."
I stared at her in my rearview mirror for a moment, in which she appeared like anyone else, and then shrugged. "Which way?"
"North, along the lake," she said. "I'm sorry, I don't know the street names. Turn right at the light ahead."
She gave directions and I followed them, and I reminded myself that it would be a bad habit to form. It took us better than half an hour to get up to one of the wealthy lakeside developments that just about any large body of water makes inevitable. I'd seen several such developments during the course of my investigations, but the area Lara directed me to was as elaborate and expensive-looking as any I had ever seen. The house we finally pulled up to had multiple wings, multiple stories, and a couple of faux castle turrets. It had cost someone 8 digits and could have doubled as the headquarters of the villain in a James Bond movie. Old timber had grown up around it and was manicured into an idyllic forest of rolling grass-green hummocks and beautiful, shapely trees wreathed in ivy and autumn leaves. Small lit pools were dotted here and there, each shrouded with its own low cloud of evening mist. The drive rolled through Little Sherwood for better than half a mile, and I started feeling nervous. If anything tried to kill me, I was too far away from the road to run for help, or even to scream for it. I shook my wrist to hear the jangle of the little silver shields on my bracelet and made sure it was ready to go at an instant's notice. Lara's pale gray eyes regarded me in the rearview mirror for a moment, and then she said,
"Dresden, you and my brother have nothing further to fear from me this night. I will respect our truce and extend guest rights to you while you are in my family's home, and I do so swear it."
I frowned and didn't chance a look at her eyes, even in the mirror. I didn't have to. There was something in her voice that I recognized. Call it the ring of truth. The one advantage to dealing with supernatural foes was that the code of honor of the old world was accepted and expected when we negotiated with one another. The sworn oath and the obligations of hospitality were more binding in those circles than the threat of physical force. What Lara had offered me meant that not only would she not attempt to do me harm, she would be obligated to protect me should anyone else attempt to do so. If she failed in her duties as a host, it would represent a major loss of face should word of it get around. But from what I'd gathered, Lara wasn't the one making all the calls in the Wraith household. If someone up the family food chain, for example, Daddy Wraith, thought he could get away with it without word leaking out, he might decide to subtract me from the old equation of life. It was a real risk, and I didn't want to take it. The last vampire who had offered me the hospitality of her home, Bianca, had drugged me, nearly killed me, manipulated me into starting a war, which incidentally forced me into a stupidly dangerous investigation with the Queens of Faerie, and tried to feed me to her most recent vampire recruit, my former lover, Susan. There was no reason to think that Lara wasn't capable of the same treachery. Unfortunately, my back wasn't exactly breaking under the weight of all my options. I had no idea of how to help Thomas, and my apartment was the only place in town I would be safe. If I cut and ran, Thomas wouldn't survive it. I didn't have anything but a strong intuition that Lara would hold to the letter of our truce. 2 seconds after it was over, she'd finish what she'd started, sure, but in the meantime, we might be okay. A paranoid little voice inside reminded me that Lara seemed like she was more or less on the level, and that it should make me nervous. Their near humanity was what made the White Court so dangerous. I'd never come close to thinking that maybe Bianca was an okay person underneath the blood-craving monster. I'd known that she wasn't human, and I'd been wary every single time I'd interacted with her. I didn't get any more of a creature-feature vibe from Lara than I did from Thomas. But I had to figure they were cut from a similar mold. There would be lies under lies. I had to be paranoid, which in this instance was another word for smart. I couldn't afford to extend Lara much trust if I wanted to avoid a rerun of the Harry nearly dies because of his stupid chivalry show. I promised myself that the second anything got dicey, I would blast my way out of that house through the nearest wall, incinerating first and asking questions later. It wouldn't be the subtlest escape in the whole world, but I was pretty sure the Wraiths could afford to repair the damages. I wondered if vampires had any trouble getting homeowners insurance. I pulled the Blue Beetle around the circular drive in front of Chateau Wraith. Its engine shuddered, coughed, and finally died before I could shut it down. A sidewalk swept between a pair of vicious-looking stone gargoyles 4 feet high and led through a rose garden bedded with pure white gravel. The rose vines were old ones, some of them as thick as my thumb. Their spreading tendrils twined all around the entirety of the garden and over the feet of the crouching gargoyles. The lighting was all arranged in soft blues and greens, and it made the roses on the vines look black. Thick leaves grew all over the vines, but here and there I could see the wicked needle tips of larger-than-average thorns. The air was filled with their light, heady scent. "Help Inari," Lara said. "I will carry Thomas."
"Considering that you're the one who shot him in the first place, I'll carry Thomas," I said. "You help Inari."
Her lips compressed slightly, but she nodded.
"As you wish."
Damn straight as I wish.
Lara leaned over to pull Inari from the car, but before she could touch the girl, the notch-eared puppy sprang up out of his sleep, barking and snarling at Lara in squeaky fury. Lara jerked her hand back, brows lowering in consternation.
"What's wrong with your animal?"
I sighed and slid into my leather duster, then came around to the passenger door. "I keep telling everyone he's not mine." I scooped up the little psychopath and deposited him in one of my coat pockets. He scrambled around in there for a minute and then he managed to poke his head out. The puppy kept his eyes on Lara and kept growling. There, now the beast cannot harm you. Lara gave me a cool look and coaxed Inari to her feet. Then she helped me draw Thomas out of the car as gently as possible. He was flaccid and cold, his eyes entirely white, but I could hear his labored breathing. Without knowing the extent of the injuries to his upper body, I didn't dare risk a fireman's carry, so I got an arm under his shoulder blades and hamstrings and lifted him like a child. He was heavy. My shoulders screamed, and my ears started ringing with a quiet, shrill tone. I felt dizzy for a second and shrugged it off with an effort of will. I couldn't afford to show any weakness now. I followed Lara and Inari up the sidewalk to the house. Lara pushed a button on a small plastic panel beside the door and said, "Lara Wraith." There was a heavy metallic click-clack, and one of the doors drifted slowly in. Just then, the lights of another car swept across us. A white limo pulled in beside the Blue Beetle on the circular drive and came to a halt. A moment later, a white sedan pulled in behind the limo. The limo's driver was a woman, over 6 feet tall, wearing a gray uniform. Her hair was pulled back in a severe braid, and she wore dark red lipstick. A tall, strong-looking man in a gray silk suit got out of the passenger side of the limo. I caught sight of a shoulder rig while he was settling his jacket. His eyes swept around, taking in everything, including us at the door, the drive, the grounds, the trees, and the roof of the house. He was checking possible lines of fire, a bodyguard. Simultaneously, another man and woman got out of the white sedan. At first, I thought they were the same two people. I blinked. The man looked the same, but the second woman was wearing a gray suit, a lot like the one of the man with her. Then I got it. Two sets of identical twins. They all looked wary, competent, and dangerous. They fanned out around the limo in silent coordination, like they'd done it a jillion times. Then the driver opened the back door of a limo. The air grew suddenly colder, as if the Almighty had flicked on the air conditioning. A man slid out of the car. He was about 6 feet tall, dark of hair, and pale of flesh. He was dressed in a white linen suit with a silver-gray silk shirt and Italian leather shoes. There was a scarlet gem of some kind fixed to his left earlobe, though his fine, straight hair hid it until a breeze briefly tossed the dark strands to one side. He had long, spatulate fingers, broad shoulders, the eyes of a drowsy jaguar, and he was better looking than Thomas. Beside me, Lara shuddered, and I heard her whisper, "Damn it, no." The newcomer walked over to us very slowly and deliberately. The doubles fell into position to his sides and behind him, and I couldn't help but think they looked like toys. Two matched sets of bodyguard Barbie and bodyguard Ken. The pale man paused beside one of the gargoyles and plucked a stem and a rose from one of the plants there. Then he approached again, in no hurry whatsoever, plucking off leaves and thorns from the flower one by one. When he was about 4 feet away, he stopped, finally looking up from the rose.
"Ah, dearest Lara," he murmured. His voice was deep, quiet, and as smooth as warm honey. "What a pleasant surprise to find you here."
Lara's expression slipped into a neutral mask, veiling the anxiety I could feel in the tension of her body. She inclined her head in a courtly nod and left her eyes on the sidewalk. The man smiled. His eyes swept over the rest of us, meanwhile, distant and alien.
"Have you been well?"
"Yes, my lord."
His lips pursed into a pout.
"This is hardly a formal occasion, little Lara. I've missed you."
Lara sighed. She met my eyes for a second, her expression one of warning. Then she turned to step closer to the man. She kissed his cheek without lifting her eyes and whispered,
"And I you, father?"
Oh, crap.
Chapter 19. Lord Wraith looked Lara up and down.
That's quite a novel ensemble you're wearing.
It's been a busy night.
Wraith nodded and went to Inari, gently touching her shoulder, peering at her arm in the makeshift sling.
What happened to you, daughter mine?
Inari lifted eyes, dull with pain and fatigue, and said,
We were mugged, or something. I think it must have been a gang. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Wraith didn't hesitate a beat.
Of course it does, dearest.
He fixed his eyes on Lara and said, How could you let something like this happen to your baby sister?
Forgive me, father, Lara said.
Wraith waved a generous hand.
She needs medical attention, Lara. I believe hospitals provide such a thing.
Bruce is here, Lara said. I'm sure he can take care of it.
Which is Bruce?
I would have expected her tone to hold annoyance, but if so, I didn't hear it.
The doctor.
He came with you from California? How fortuitous.
I couldn't take it anymore. Hey, people, chat time is over. The girl's about to pass out on her feet. Thomas is dying, so both of you shut your mouth and help them.
Wraith whipped his head around to stare daggers at me. His voice was cold enough to merit the use of a Kelvin scale.
I do not respond well to demands.
I ground my teeth and said, Both of you shut your mouth and help them. Please.
And they say I can't be diplomatic.
Wraith flicked an irritated hand at the bookend brigade. Bodyguard Kens and Barbies drew their guns in precise unison and raised them to shoot.
No,
Lara said. She stepped in front of me and Thomas. You can't.
Can't?
Wraith said. His voice was dangerously mild.
They might hit Thomas.
I am confident in their marksmanship. They will not hit him, Wraith said, in a tone that suggested he wouldn't lose any sleep if they did.
I've invited him, Lara said.
Wraith stared at her for a moment, and then in that same soft voice asked,
Why?
Because we declared a 24-hour truce while he assisted us, Lara answered. If not for his help, we might all be dead.
Wraith's head tilted to one side. He regarded me for a long moment and then smiled. He didn't have Thomas beat when it came to smiles. Thomas's grin had so much life to it that it was practically sentient. Lord Wraith's smile made me think of sharks and skulls.
I suppose it would be churlish to ignore my debt to you, young man. I will honor the truce and respect my daughter's invitation and hospitality. Thank you for your assistance.
Whatever, I said. Would you both shut your mouths and help them now? Pretty please, with sugar on top.
I used to admire that kind of monolithic determination.
Wraith waved his hand again, though his eyes looked no less cold. The thugs put their guns away. One man and one woman went to Inari, supporting her and helping her into the house.
Lara, bring your physician to her quarters, if you would, assuming he has mind enough left to treat her.
She bowed her head again, and something told me she resented doing it.
I'll expect you and Thomas in my chambers at dawn so that we can discuss what happened. Oh, and if you would, Wizard Dresden.
The king of the White Court knew me on sight.
This just kept getting better and better.
Lara can show you where Thomas's chambers are. That girl of his is there, I think.
Lord Wraith drifted into the house, paced by his retainers. By my count, there were still two whole goons available for Thomas toting, but I grunted like a big tough guy and set out to do it myself. We started walking into the house.
Nice guy, I commented to Lara. I was a little short of breath, and I was all worried about meeting him.
I know, Lara murmured. He was really quite pleasant.
Except for the eyes, I said. She glanced at me again, something like approval in her features.
You saw that?
That's what I do. She nodded.
Then please believe me when I say that deception is what we do, wizard. My father does not like you. I suspect he wishes to kill you.
I get that a lot.
She smiled at me, and I got hit with another surge of lust, maybe one that wasn't entirely inspired by her come-hither mojo. She was a smart, tough lady, and had plenty of courage. I had to respect that. And she was gliding along beside me, dressed in skimpy black lingerie. Admittedly, the blood and ichor detracted from the overall look, but it gave me a good excuse to see the rest of her while making my assessment. We went up a shallow, curving stairwell and down a long hall. I tried to stick mental landmarks into my memory so that I'd be able to leave in a hurry if I needed to. My vision blurred for a moment, and the high-pitched buzzing in my ears increased in volume. I took a breath and steadied myself against the wall. Here, Lara said. She turned to me and took Thomas. Either she was stronger than me, or she was good at acting like it was no big deal. Probably both. I rolled my aching shoulders in relief. Thanks. How is he?
The bullets aren't going to kill him, she said. He'd have died already. The hunger may finish him, though.
I arched an eyebrow at her in question.
The hunger, she repeated. Our need to feed. The angel of our darker natures. We can draw upon it to give us a kind of strength, but it's like fire. It can turn on you if you don't keep it under control. Right now, Thomas is so hungry that he can't think, can't move. He'll be all right once he feeds.
I felt an itch on the back of my neck and checked over my shoulder.
Your father's driver is tailing us.
Lara nodded. She'll dispose of the body. I blinked.
I thought you said he was going to be all right.
He will be, Lara said, her tone carefully neutral. Justine won't.
What?
He's too hungry, Lara said. He won't be able to control himself.
Fuck that, I said. That isn't going to happen.
Then he'll die, Lara said tiredly. This is the door to his suite. She stopped at the door, and with my reflexes on automatic pilot, I opened it for her. We went into a rather large room, dominated by a sunken pit in the floor. The carpet was lush, a dark crimson. Pillows were all over, and a smoking brazier rested in the center of the pit. The air was heavy with sweet incense. Quiet jazz drifted through the room from speakers I couldn't see. On the opposite side of the room, a curtain twitched, and then a girl appeared from what was evidently a room beyond. Justine's shoulder-length dark hair had been striped with trendy strands of dark blue and deep purple. She wore a white bathrobe several sizes too large for her and looked rumpled from sleep. She blinked dark, sleepy eyes and then gasped and rushed toward us.
Thomas! My God!
I looked back over my shoulder. The driver stood just outside the doorway, speaking quietly into a cellular phone. Lara carried Thomas down into the pit and carefully laid him upon the pillows and cushions, Justine at her side. The girl's face was twisted in anxiety.
Harry? What happened to him?
Lara glanced up at me and said, I need to make sure Inari is cared for, if you will excuse me.
I didn't, but she left the room anyway.
Justine stared up at me, fear and confusion on her face.
I don't understand.
Lara shot him, I said quietly, and then some black court gorillas jumped us.
Lara?
Didn't seem like she liked the idea, but she sure as hell gave it a whirl. Lara said he'd spent his reserves fighting, and that he would die if he didn't feed. Justine's eyes flicked up to the doorway. She saw the driver standing outside. Justine's face blanched.
Oh, she whispered. Tears formed in her eyes.
Oh, no. No. No, she said. My poor Thomas.
I stepped forward. You don't have to do this.
But he'll die.
Do you think he'd want it to be you instead? Her lips trembled and she closed her eyes for a moment.
I don't know. I've seen him. I know there's a part of him that wants to.
And there's another part that doesn't, I said, that would want you to be alive and happy. She settled on her knees beside Thomas, staring down at him. She put her fingers on his cheek, and he moved for the first time since the fight with One Ear. He turned his head and placed a soft kiss on Justine's hand. The girl shivered.
He might not take too much. He tries so hard not to take too much, not to hurt me. He might stop himself.
Do you really believe that? She was silent for a long moment and then said,
It doesn't matter. I can't stand by and let him die when I can help him.
Why not? She looked up at me, her eyes steady.
I love him.
You're addicted to him, I said.
That too, she agreed. But it doesn't change anything. I love him.
Even if it kills you? I asked. She bowed her head, gently stroking Thomas's cheek.
Of course.
I started to refute her, but just then the rush of energy from the silver belt buckle petered out. I started trembling violently. The pain of my injuries rushed back over me. Fatigue settled onto me like a backpack full of lead. My thoughts turned to exhausted sludge. I vaguely remember Justine cajoling me to my feet and guiding me back through one of the curtains to a lavish bedroom. She helped me onto the bed and said,
You'll tell him for me, won't you?
She was crying through a small smile.
You'll tell him what I said? That I love him?
The room was spinning, but I promised her that I would. She kissed my forehead and gave me a sad smile.
Thank you, Harry. You've always helped us.
My vision narrowed to a gray tunnel. I tried to get back up again, but I could barely manage to turn my head. So all I could do was watch Justine slide out of the bathrobe and leave the room to go to Thomas and to her death.